Hi everyone, welcome to today's call. I see that we have some new members with us. A special welcome to you all. We're glad you could join us today. We have a few announcements before Ellen tells us about today's call. Our next monthly clinical call is February 14th at 11 a.m. Pacific. Greta DeLabo will present a case. The next bonus call is February 3rd at 1 p.m. Pacific. Michelle Wangler-Joy will discuss premarital counseling. And the next special training session is February 10th at noon Pacific. Catherine Waddell will demonstrate how to introduce and set up the initiator inquirer. And if you'd like to present a case at one of our training calls, please email ruth@couplesinstitute.com. This is a great opportunity to get direct supervision from Ellen. And finally, Ellen will stay on at the end of the call to answer questions about the training program. And that's it for me, Ellen.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. Just one more thing about the muting. If you're on an iPhone or cell phone, sometimes it means that you got to be the one who mutes yourself. We can't always mute it, and it really helps if we can have quiet during the teaching, and then you can unmute yourself when you need to so that you can come in and talk. So today is really designed for a few things. One is to help those of you who want to get more solidly rooted in an understanding of the basics, some basics of the developmental model. And so I'll be doing some teaching and some PowerPoint slides on the developmental model. As Ruth said, I'll also stay on at the end so that any of you who have questions about the program or who want my help in really orienting yourself to what's the best way for you to learn, then I'll be spending time to help you do that. We also have Tammy Van Hinty with us today. And Tammy is a counselor in Victoria, BC. She's been in the program since 2017. And she put together just some wonderful material about really patterns of change and how do you intervene in a way that supports the couple changing. And so I asked her to join me today to share some of that with you, because I think it's a good way to have some ideas to get started and use while you're learning more of the theory and some of the interventions. So Tammy will be doing that with us as well. And you know, overall, I want to say for some of you, as you go through this training, you'll decide you want to be a couples therapy specialist. And it's really possible to do that. And there are many couples therapy specialists around. For some of you, you'll only see 2, 3, 4 couples at a time, but you'll know that you really know what you're doing and that you can feel confident in what you're doing and not so much a flying by the seat of your pants, which works. Intuition works for a while, but it doesn't work in a sustained way when you work with a lot of difficult couples. So let me share my screen. I'm going to put up a PowerPoint. Give me 1 second here. Okay, there we go. Can everybody see? You can see it. Tammy, can you see it?
I can see it.
Okay, great. That means it's up. Okay. So the developmental model is a theory of understanding what goes on in couples' relationships. And one thing that's important to me about it is it's not a pathology model. It's a model that really looks at the individuals who come to see us as kind of being in a developmental process, a process where we can look at the struggles that people are having and see those struggles as part of a struggle for more psychological growth, health, development, and also understand people from the context in which they come and understand that different folks are coming from different contexts in their own experience and they're bringing that into their relationship as well. But what the model gives you is a way to have an ability to not only understand and see what's going on now with a couple that's in front of you, but to really be able to have a strong leadership role, being able to see what's possible for that couple and help to take them there. And that becomes important, especially when people hit those really difficult moments where they're in despair or they think they can't possibly do it better or they're not going to make it. And I mean, sure, there are some couples who don't make it, but overall, when you understand the dynamics of some of their struggles and what's going on, you can be the one who has the hope, or you can hold the hope, or you can hold the insight and show them indeed what is possible for them. So beginning, and Tammy's going to talk some about this, but right from the very beginning, the stronger your leadership role is, it's going to affect almost everything that you do with a couple. It's going to affect the tone you, it's going to affect the way that you take charge from the minute you start the session and how you start the session. And it's on, and what you help them focus on, because it is just almost automatic with most couples that when they come in the room, they're going to focus on telling you everything that's not working. And they're going to blame the other person. They're going to tell you what's wrong. And it's a crucial part of couples therapy to know how to shift that focus and how to help them both see what they're doing, that they're doing well, and also see what the developmental capacities are that are missing so that they can shift the negative cycles that they get into. And so really, and you're going to see a lot more of this as you move forward in the program, but the ways that you challenge your clients to develop themselves and understand that making individual changes is going to have a powerful impact on what they do with each other and how they recreate their relationship. So I put up on this slide some of the things that I think are important in the first or the early sessions. And we will be going into this more. There's a wonderful call on the training site for my husband called Rethinking First Sessions that goes into a lot of ways that you can structure a first session. And there's also a special training call just specifically focused on getting off to a strong start. But, you know, some of the goals of early in couples work are to establish yourself as that leader, to start right away not being reactive to what the couple brings in, but being able to be active and know a sense of flow, your sense of direction. You want to be able to get the couple's attention. And by getting their attention, I'm really talking especially about some of the really fighting couples, because you want them, they're going to have to do the work, that you're going to be the guide, but there's going to be a lot of work that has to be done on their part, but also that you are optimistic about what's possible so that they do have hope and a willingness to dive in and really apply themselves. The things that get in the way for pretty much most couples, number one, they don't have inherently the support that would help them move through the developmental stages. And later in this session, I'm going to talk about the stages specifically, but they don't either have the internal support for themselves, or they may not have support from friends or family to say, hey, some of what you're going through is normal and natural, and you can get through it. instead, you know, many times, for example, many times, you know, women will go to their friends and their friends will say, your husband's a jerk. And they don't have the support for developing themselves and pushing themselves. And then that affects how they view their partner and how they view what's going on. For just about everybody, there's some things in our early history, our early development, that we didn't get. And some of those developmental capacities that we didn't develop show up when we're trying to create a really healthy, loving, long-term, sustained relationship. There's also repetitive re-triggering of early trauma or emotional trauma, and very few people know how to repair that. And over time, it can get worse and worse instead of better and better. And there's just a bunch of skills that it takes to have a good relationship. We put so many demands now on our relationship to be so much. And it takes a lot of skills to be in a successful interdependent relationship, a loving interdependent relationship. And many of those skills, many of the people who come to see us just don't have. So some of the ways that your leadership is going to show up, and I'm going to turn things over to Tammy in a minute or two, but some of the ways your leadership shows up is that you are able to sustain positive momentum. Like, you don't let yourself get pulled in really negative directions that are not going to go anywhere with a couple. And that, the longer you work with a couple, the more you know that. You know what things are going to go nowhere. And so you avoid getting stuck in those repetitive negative cycles. And in fact, you know how to structure interventions or exercises or ways they talk to each other that will keep them out of that when they're in the room with you. You learn how to manage volatility really, really fast. You know, that was a hard one for me when I started working with couples, because I came from a very conflictive and a family where, you know, I was supposed to be good. And being good meant you didn't interrupt anybody, you never talked over anybody. And with volatile couples, you just need to be able to incisively come in and stop some of the fighting. Another challenge of being a good couples therapist is, how do you create alignment with each partner so that that partner feels like you really do get them and you are going to work for their best interest, but you're not aligning with the regressed parts of them or the victim parts of them or the blaming parts of them. And so the challenge at the beginning of couples work especially is that alignment that you're creating with each partner. You learn how to focus attention on really high leverage areas, so you know where you're most likely to have change come from. And you target goals that will have impact. And I talk a lot, and you'll see some in some of the other sessions, but what I call autonomous goals, so that when you set a goal with one partner, commitment to working on that, whether their partner does something or not. And the more enmeshed a couple is, the more symbiotic they are, the more important that is, because the more people will say things to you like, well, I didn't do my homework because it didn't seem like he or she were going to do their homework. Or, you know, I started out the week thinking I was going to be pick up the clutter around the house, but then I noticed that he came home late one night, and so I thought, why bother? And there's so much of that that goes on in couples, where when you can begin to separate it out and say, you know, will you do whatever the thing is that you're talking about? Will you do X, whether or not your partner does Y? The more leverage you have with that individual, and also the more you're not dependent every week on the least motivated partner doing the most changing. Because if the least motivated partner doesn't do what they say they're going to do, then the other person collapses and gives up too. So, you know, Tammy put together a wonderful handout, and it's on the website for today's call. And Tammy, how about if you explain sort of the background first of, you know, what's behind what you put together, and I think I'll take us off the screen share for a minute and bring you in. So,
right, thank you, Ellen. So the background is that I had an idea. I was trying to figure out, how can I be like Ellen? You know, I see what Ellen does and I think, wow, that's amazing. And then I go and I'm with my own clients and I think, I'm not doing the same thing. What is it? How do I actually start to take the knowledge that I'm gaining from this program, this therapeutic knowledge about the developmental model, and how do I start to transform that into skillful interventions in my own sessions? So that's what I was exploring. And when I thought about that, I guess I want to start by just saying that for a lot of people on this call, it's your first call. And when you first join the program, there is a bit of just figuring out how the program works and getting oriented. And then you start to understand the developmental model. You start to conceptualize your cases. But then you start to look at, how do I actually take these interventions into my sessions? So that'll come. And if you feel like this is a little bit further ahead than where you are, you can always come back to this call and you can listen to it because it is being recorded. So when I asked myself that question, when I said, how do I transform the knowledge of the developmental model into skillful interventions? This was the answer that I came up with. I thought, I can observe the process that an experienced therapist uses. I can identify what they do. And then I can attempt to do that in my own sessions. So what I did is I used this strategy and I started to track, what is Ellen actually doing? And when I did that, I came to some conclusions. So I want to share those with you today, and I want to hear what you think of that. And I'm also really excited to hear what Ellen thinks of that. So the first thing that I noticed was that Ellen uses patterned responses to facilitate change in her clients. So what do I mean by that? She uses patterned responses to facilitate change in her clients. So by a patterned response, I mean that she doesn't use just one skill on its own. Rather, she puts a number of skills together in a patterned way. So I think about this as being similar to a couple of different analogies. One would be building things. So if I want to be able to build things the way that a master builder builds things, I know I need tools. I've got a hammer, I've got a saw, and I've got measuring tapes. That's great. I know that's what the builder has. But it's not enough for me to just have the same tools in my toolbox. I actually need to be able to understand, what order does that builder use those tools in? And then I recognize, oh, first they measure, then they use the saw to cut the wood, and then they use the hammer to nail it. And only when I put those tools together in the same patterned way will I be able to replicate what they've created. Another analogy might be cooking. So if I have a master chef that I really admire and I want to be able to cook in the same way, it's not enough to know what the ingredients are in that recipe. I actually need to know the process about how those ingredients are put together. And so that's how I started to think about it, that it's not enough to be able to look at something that Ellen does and say, oh, can I do that? But actually to start to be able to put those things that she's doing together in the same kind of a patterned way, if I want to be able to create the same result. So I'm going to give you an example of that. So Ellen will confront symbiosis, and she's going to talk a little bit more about what symbiosis is. But she will make a confrontation of the client's symbiotic response. And when she does that, my experience is that she doesn't just confront. She always does what I call an internal check. So she confronts the client by making a statement that is confronting the way that they're approaching the relationship or the interaction or the problem. And then she asks them, what is their experience of that confrontation? And then what I notice is that she responds to whatever they tell her. So if they tell her that it was fine, then she'll continue as is. But if they get defensive and reactive, then she has that information that person is having a defensive response or a pull for symbiosis. And so it would be necessary to have gentler confrontations in the future. And she might do something like empathize with that defensiveness, empathize with that desire for symbiotic relationship, and then move forward into the next step. So after she confronts and does the internal check, she also then likely asks the client for a commitment to change, an autonomous goal. And then after that, what I've seen her do is explore the benefits with the client. Why would you want to do that? So the pattern is confront, do an internal check, ask for a commitment to an autonomous goal, and explore the benefits. This is also a place where Ellen may explore the resistance to change and maybe do some two-chair work. Is there anything you want to add, Ellen?
Well, yeah, a couple things. First of all, I want to say that when Tammy first met me, it was neat for me because I don't stop and think, oh, this is what I do and this is the order I do it in. I do think about what creates change, and you're going to hear tons of me teaching about what creates change. But it was exciting and interesting to me to see how Tammy had put it together. And I want to say that as she's describing some of this, each of you are going to have your own. So I don't train in a way that I try to get people to be copycats of me, because I don't think anybody who's a copycat, you're not going to be yourself and you're not going to feel alive in the room. But I think Tammy has done a good job of really figuring out some of the good order that things can happen in, and some things that do that are based in me having now, you know, 30 some years of experience of working with couples, where I do know some things that work and some things that are going to get you in trouble. For example, just based on what Tammy was just talking about, if I confront somebody and they're getting really defensive and I just overlook that, I'm going to get pushback one way or the other. Either they're leave the session and act out in some way, or they're going to dig in and get resistant with me. So I certainly don't want to just ignore somebody's defensiveness. Now, one other thing that Ruth just sent me a message saying, Tammy, how did you do these observations of me working? So I think it'd be great if you could say, like, you know, was it from the videos on the site or from role plays, or just where are some of the places that you did the observations?
So the places are the videos, and it's also the role plays. It's both. And I also own all of the videos that you sell as well. So what I just did naturally is that when I would see what you were doing, I would stop and start to categorize it and write out word for word what it is that you had said in the category that I thought that it might fit.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's why, like I said, you helped me learn something about myself when you sent it to me.
I appreciate how open you are to looking at it.
Absolutely. So do you want to go on and share some more of the interventions? And again, if you guys have questions, you can put them in the chat or unmute yourself and come in and ask Tammy too, if there's anything that you comment on.
So the next thing that when I'm talking about, Ellen facilitates pattern responses to facilitate, she uses pattern responses to facilitate change in her clients. She facilitates change. Facilitates a pretty key word. She doesn't explain or offer psychoeducational format to create change. She coaches the clients to increase their skills. So I'm going to give you an example of that. So she asks questions to encourage clients to notice what's happening inside of them and to choose a self-soothing response, like a positive statement about the benefit of the goal. She might help a client who's struggling not to take what their partner's saying personally to find a self-affirmation, something like, this is not about me. My partner is sharing their experience with me. If I become defensive and reactive, I will not know my partner. I want to know my partner's truth. And then when the client is becoming reactive as they're listening to their partner, they could catch that and just remind themselves, I want to know my partner's truth. I want to know my partner's truth. So it's a skill that the client can then use when they're becoming reactive. So I think that's a really important point. She doesn't just explain that to the client. She helps them find those words for themselves and hold those words in their own mind.
And, you know, and those phrases, like one I use a lot is, it's not about me, when somebody's listening to their partner, because so many people take things so personally. But, you know, I want the client to have words that they can use at home, and it becomes it's a kind of internal self-soothing. It's an internal self-management, so that they have something to hold on to when they're trying to get a grip on and not escalate in a way that they might have escalated before.
So the next thing that I noticed is that Ellen focuses on the client's process and doesn't get pulled into their content. So my conclusion about this is that, and I'm very curious to hear what you think, Ellen. My conclusion is that Ellen is always holding three processes in her mind at all times. One, the process that's happening between the clients. Two, the process that's happening within each client. And then three, the process that's happening within herself. And I'm particularly interested in the process that's happening within you, Ellen, because of course I can't directly observe that, but I make that conclusion from some things like, when we are presenting cases, you will stop and ask what was happening for you in that moment. So you're encouraging us to be aware of our own internal process. So I draw from that a conclusion that you're also monitoring your own. So I'd really love to hear your own take on what I just said, if you have an experience of yourself holding all three processes, or if it's different for you.
It's a great question. And I'll say a couple things. One is, I do give attention to the process. Like, I look at the content of what somebody brings in as mostly an avenue to facilitate a different process, or to facilitate the development of new capacities in that person. Because, I mean, the majority of clients, not everybody, I mean, sometimes people come in on very specific decision they need to make, or something that's very, very targeted. But the majority of people who come have things in their process that get in the way of them being able to be successful with each other when there's a lot of tension or a lot of heat. I'm working right now with a couple with a very narcissistic in it, and I've been working with him long enough that we now have a really good relationship, but there's been a lot of work that's gone into that. And he said something really interesting yesterday. He said, I had treatment resistant aggression, and I was not going to let you get through that aggression. And there were so many sessions in which I said to him things like, you know, if you continue the process the way you're doing it, you're not ever going to get the outcome you continue to speak to your wife that way, you're not going to get, or if you continue to fight me, you're not going to get the outcome that you're looking for. And so so I am focusing a lot on the process. And I do, Tammy, you're right, I do pay attention to what's going on inside of me, as well as what I'm observing going on in the process between the two people who are sitting in front of me. And over time, I've come to trust my internal process a lot. Like, if I am experiencing something somebody says as, ooh, that was a loaded message. Now, I may not know exactly what I'm going to say right away, but I know that I can't ignore what my experience was in that moment. Like, somehow in that session, or no later than the beginning of a following session, I'm going to weave that in some way to the interventions. Because again, that is an important part of changing the process on. Or, you know, if I'm feeling afraid of a client, then I ask myself, oh, is the partner also feeling afraid of them? And what is the dynamic that's creating that fear inside of me? Now, clearly there are times that our own countertransference gets activated and maybe it is more about us. But the longer you do the work and the more experienced you are and the more of your own personal therapy you've done, the more that sense of paying attention to me is also a lot about what's going on in the room. Oh, Tammy, does that answer what you were
asking? That's really interesting, because when I was thinking about paying attention to what's happening inside of my own self, I'm thinking about it more from the perspective that I need to be aware of my own reactivity, and I need to be sure that I'm not leading from reactivity, but rather I'm setting my reactivity aside and I'm leading from a more centered place. But what I hear you saying is that there's also the ability to recognize that reactivity that I'm having in this moment may also be an indicator of what a partner might be experiencing, and that I might want to ask myself that question. It might inform what's happening in the room.
I think over time, the more couples work you do, and, you know, because at the beginning, certainly when I was first working with couples, I was reactive because I'd never heard people treat each other the way some people would treat each other or whatever. And it was, you know, but I've been doing it long enough now that I know that a lot more of what I'm reacting to is something that needs to be fed into the interventions.
Mm-hmm. So the capacity to be able to differentiate between that is really what we want to aspire to.
Yeah.
That's great. I love that. Do you feel like you're also always monitoring what's happening inside of the clients, or
I'm trying to, yeah. I'm pretty aware of the nonverbal cues, and I am looking to see what's going on. And that's really especially true with highly reactive or highly angry and aggressive clients, because I want to catch it if I can before they really escalate, before they lose it, or before they walk out of the room and slam the door, whatever. I want to slow things down and say, wait a minute, you know, it looks like you're having a really hard time right now. And can we take some time to figure out what's happening so that you can be present? And so, yeah, I try to pay a lot of attention.
The other thing that I've noticed is that it's important to do the internal check, even when it appears as though people are not reactive, because I found that there are some clients who are quite compliant, and they'll come in and they actually will do what appears to be on the surface level quite a good job of the initiator inquirer, which all of the new people here, you will learn that intervention, and they will do that, and the initiator inquirer, and they do not appear reactive, but actually they're very reactive, and then they go home and they have it out and they say, this is making it worse. So I think that internal check's really important, regardless of what we perceive to be happening within the clients, ourselves. Yeah. I've not picked up on it sometimes.
No, absolutely. And that would be, you know, really good times to check are, let's say you've done an exercise or a particular intervention in a session, or certainly before the session is over, like as you're getting down to the last 5 minutes, to say things like, I want to check in with how is this today for each of you? What are you feeling as you get ready to go home? Stuff like that, that checks in and monitors what's happening.
Right. That's great. We talk about how to set like the good context for starting therapy, but it's also important to have a good way of closing.
Yeah. I see a question from somebody, Tammy, who says, do you have any tips for when a client is very disconnected from their feelings or emotions?
It's difficult, isn't it? What would you say, Ellen?
I mean, I would say that when somebody is very internally disconnected from themselves, we're talking about a very low level of differentiation, because the first capacity in differentiation is to be able to internally self-reflect, to be able to slow down and ask yourself, what am I feeling or what am I thinking? And when a client is very, very disconnected, that beginning part of differentiation can be slow. It can be, you know, probably most of you have seen some of those feeling faces charts. Sometimes with somebody very disconnected, I will try to have them going to a good group therapy, because group therapy is very powerful in seeing other people talk about their emotions and starting to recognize what your own emotions are. So it really depends on the situation. And there are some clients, like the wife of this particular guy that I was just talking about, who was very disconnected from herself when she started, but with not that much support, with me being able to ask her and start to validate some of what she's put forth, she actually took off much faster than I thought in terms of being able to say, wow, you know, I realize I've been in a box. I put myself in a box and I'm coming out of that box now. So you'll see sometimes people where it takes a long time and some with the right support where they can move a lot quicker.
How I'd summarize what you just said is it's a way of being able to identify how to have the developmental assist be aligned with the developmental level of the client. So if the client is not able to identify their feelings, we know that that's the place we're working, is to just start to help them be able to identify their feelings so that they can then speak them to their partner.
Yeah, that was well said, Tammy, because something I teach a lot about is giving developmental assists, recognizing where the client is, and then intervening in a way that is that stepping stone. It meets them where they are, and then it gives them a way to go to the very next step, and not to be too far ahead of them, because if you're too far ahead of where the client is, you'll end up frustrated, they'll end up frustrated, and they're not able to do what you're asking them to do many times.
Mm-hmm. I've experienced it a lot. I'm working on aligning my developmental assist to the level of the client. Is it a good place to ask if anyone has comments or questions, or should we move on, Ellen?
Well, let's take a quick pause and see if anybody does have questions. And you can unmute yourself if you do. Okay, well, I see one question, which was Holly asking, can you give an example of when an assist is too far ahead of the client? Tammy, do you want to think of one where you realized you were way ahead of somebody, or do you want me to take it?
Well, I think that if I think about the paper exercise questions, and the first question is, can they self-define? And if I find myself working at a higher level, trying to help people resolve conflict, and they can't even define themselves, I'm way too far ahead. I can't think of a very specific example of that. And I think that's probably because that is exactly what I'm learning right now. And I should take what I'm talking about here today and apply it to that issue, where I look at what is the developmental assist I gave, what's the one you might, and I think I would clearly be able to see a specific example of how I'm doing something different. I'm asking questions that are at a higher level, like the level of boundaries rather than the level of defining self.
That's a good example. Both of those are good examples. If somebody doesn't have the capacity to define themselves and hold on to what they think, feel, or desire, you know, more than for a second or two, I mean, they really can't hold on to that, their capacity to resolve conflict with their partner will be very, very, very minimal. And what they'll, you know, they may get into a conflict situation and start to yell or scream at the partner, but they won't be able to say, wait a minute, I hear this is what you think and feel, what are we going to do about it? They're not able to hold those two realities for a minute that just say, wait, we have two different realities right now.
Because the capacity to hold my partner as separate is more advanced than my capacity to self-define and share it with my partner. So if I'm not able to do that, I'm not going to be able to hold space and have that other differentiation from my partner in the way that would be required to resolve conflict.
Yeah.
Should we move to the patterns?
Yeah, I think what I was going to say is move to the patterns, and then, you know, in about 5 or so, 10 minutes, I would love to move into teaching some about the stages. So,
sure. Do you want me to start at the beginning?
I think so.
Okay. So I've categorized what I saw Ellen do into some different categories. The first one is early sessions. So when we're starting sessions with clients, as Ellen's already been talking about, we want to be able to set the context and have good leadership. And so we also want to get their consent or buy-in for what the work is going to be. Ask for commitment and then ask them to let you know if they're becoming defensive or you're pushing too hard. I think in this example that we're about to give, not only is Ellen set, how is she setting the context? I guess this is something that's coming up raw right now. She's setting the context by actually demonstrating the work, demonstrating what would be required in the sessions in order to increase differentiation and to create change. So the example in this case is when a previously deceived partner asks about their partner's whereabouts, and the client who cheated says that their partner is just being jealous and that they need to get over the affair. You want to read it, Ellen?
So I said, are you aware that each time he brings up the reality of how your behavior has affected him, you're pretty quick to turn it back on him? Are you aware of that?
Well, I've been silenced for so long. I just want to have a voice.
Both things are right. It's important for you to have a voice, definitely, and for you to know what you're thinking and feeling and to put it out. But it's also important for you to have a deeper appreciation of what you do and the effect you have on him. I wonder what it's like when I say that to you.
Well, I'm feeling a lot of guilt.
Tell me about the guilt.
Well, I know I've created a lot of pain for him, and it sounds like you're really pointing that out to me.
What I'm pointing out is not for the purpose of making you feel bad, but for you to begin to have a better awareness of your own process and what it is you do.
Okay, well, I think that would be helpful.
Okay, so if I continue to point it out, will you let me know if you get defensive with me or when you're having trouble with what I'm saying?
Yeah, that sounds good. So the pattern is that Ellen explains what the work will be in the session, and I think she's also demonstrating it in the way she's interacting with the client. She gives examples of what it is that she'd be asking the client to do. She asks for a commitment and then asks if the client would let her know if they're becoming defensive or if she's pushing too hard.
And what I would say is this particular client that Tammy put together some of the transcript from is a client who had an affair and really wanted to move past it really fast and didn't want her husband to have any emotional reaction to her having had the affair. And so when he would bring up anything about it, she would move into, well, you're just jealous, or you just, you know, or one time she called him a crybaby. and so it was very, very hard for her to get out of her own skin and have a sense that, you know, he is a person who is having some legitimate, normal feeling reactions to what had gone on.
Mm-hmm. So the next section that we have is strokes. Do we have time for that, Ellen?
Yeah, I think you could. Well, let's do that and then we'll shift.
Sure. So specifically describe the process of what the client did well and how it's different than the past, then acknowledge the courage, et cetera, that it took to do that. So the pattern that I saw Ellen using with strokes, it's not just a general stroke. It's not just generally, you're doing really well. What a great job you're doing. It's nothing like that. It's very specific. She describes specifically what the person has done, identifies how it's an indicator of growth, and then she acknowledges the strength that it takes to have done that. So do you want to read the example because you said it?
Sure. I was talking to a client and I said, can you see how you took one of those things that you've been ruminating about the affair and now you got direct about it? You took a risk, you got answers, and now you're not keeping it all in your head. Good for you for taking that risk and dealing with some really hard things. So essentially, I mean, this is a client who'd been ruminating for a long time and obsessing about the details of a very painful affair that her husband had. And that what Tammy's talking about, which is something I feel really strongly about, is when you're giving, I mean, strokes and encouragement are really, really, really important with clients when they're taking risks. But sometimes they don't see the risk, or they don't see that they've just done something they weren't able to do before. And so we want to notice, like, what is it that this person did that they weren't able to do before? And that compliment or that positive stroke is saying, hey, you took a risk and you did a really good job.
And helping them understand specifically what it is that they did so they can actually internalize it, they can take it in.
Yeah.
You want to do stroke nudge?
Sure, let's do that and then, yeah.
Okay, so then the next is stroke nudge. So once you get good at doing the stroke intervention, you can add a nudge by naming the place that the client is aiming to go. So in the example, if you have the handout, it's in bold, the nudge is in bold. So I imagine that the stroke nudge would have the following pattern. Look at where you got stuck. Look at how you moved through it. Look at how you would not have been able to do that in the past. Look at where you're going and how that's a big step in that direction.
Yeah, you're laying a foundation for people to keep doing or keep taking those risks that are hard. You know, it's a good example is there are so many clients who come in for couples work who don't know how to be intimate, don't know how to share important parts of themselves, and are afraid to do it. And so when you're able to actually, you know, nudge them to like acknowledge what they've done and then nudge them to take a risk that week. Or you may give a homework assignment to a couple last night saying to the wife, you know, you want to go on date nights, but you don't ever let yourself tell him when you're hoping for a date or when you'd like one or what you'd like to do on a date. And so just once this week, will you let him know not only that you'd like to go out with him, but let him know what it is you'd like to do? And for her, that's going to be a big risk. It's because she doesn't do that at all.
So the nudge is the part where you're holding up where it is that the person might want to go and asking them if they'd be willing to go there in your example. And in the example in the handout, it was more something that they had already done well, with sort of a light being held as to where it is that they're going when they do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Tammy, thank you a lot. And there's more that Tammy has written, and I think we will have Tammy. She can share some more of what she's put together, but I want to be sure to be able to talk some about the stages today to you, and also have time to stay on at the end for people who do have questions about the program. So
thank you, Ellen.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to send Tammy a note or a thank you in the chat, feel free to do that as well, and I'll be sure she gets it. Okay, so I think you can see the slides again. Is that right? Tammy, can you see them?
I can, yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, so I'm going to move forward a minute here. First of all, you know, when couples come to see you, there's three main categories of why they come to see you. One is they really are there for growth, change, development. They want to learn more. You know, they want to change. They really do want to change. Sometimes they come to dissolve the relationship and say goodbye or get help with parenting or help with separation. And many times couples will come in to make a decision. And sometimes those are really hard decisions, like one of them wanting to have a child and the other one not wanting to, and they're trying to decide that, or whether to stay together or split up. And so knowing what the main goal is for the work together is pretty important. It won't always be clear to begin with. But for example, let's say a couple comes in the aftermath of infidelity, and you make the assumption that they want to work on it, reconnect, grow, develop, resolve the trauma, whatever. And one person is really not there. They're like, am I going to leave? You know, do I want to leave? And you can work with a couple where they have different agendas, but it's a good idea to get those agendas clear. So one person can be there to make a decision. The other person can be there to say, I do want to change myself. I realize I'm ineffective in certain ways. That's okay, but then you know that you have two different side-by-side agendas going on. So this, you know, the developmental model is about learning how to intervene incisively. And I like this little comic where the marriage counselors got their mouths closed, because with a really fighting couple, that's a lot of what you do at the beginning is make sure you can actually get them to shut up. So let's talk about the stages of relationship. And I believe that couples' relationships can evolve through normal, predictable stages, that indeed happens, and that a lot of problems that we see in the symptoms come about when a relationship gets stuck and when the partners are not able to progress through the stages. And in fact, the longer it goes on, And the more stuck they are at the initial stage, which we'll talk more about, the more symptoms you're going to see and the more problems you're going to see. So you may have a couple who have been stuck in a very symbiotic relationship for a long time, and that couple may present with severe depression in one partner, for example. Or a hostile fighting couple may come in, they'll tell you that we can't communicate and all we ever do is fight. And that's because they have been so stuck in that first stage and it's gone on that they've done enormous damage to each other that they're not able to move past. And so if you think about yourself or people you know, the more individual development that somebody has before they get together with their partner, the stronger their capacities are going to be to support healthy relationship development. So that individual development is going to help a lot. The less individual development they have, or if you think about, you know, people who get together when they're 19 or 20 and they just haven't even grown up, they're not going to have some of the same skills and capacities as somebody does who, let's say, gets when they're 40. But also the process of couples development, when a couple gets help in a good way and they develop themselves as a couple, that will increase their individual development a lot. And that's one of the reasons why I love being a couples therapist, because you get to see that in front of your eyes often. You get to really watch and enjoy the success of somebody who not only makes changes in their marriage or their committed partnership, but they also start to feel so much better as an individual, and they're able to take more risks in their own individual life as well. Now, what Pete and I looked at early on was that the stages of parallel some of the stages of early childhood development. And Margaret Mahler's work was the one that us the most in terms of a parallel. It's not an exact one-to-one, everything is identical, but there's a lot in what she described and also what Bowlby saw in studying mothers and infants that is parallel for couples. And I'll just really briefly touch on what Margaret Mahler said, which was when a child is born, there's initially really from, I mean, she termed an autistic stage from birth to about 6 weeks, where the main thing a child is doing is just getting acclimated to being outside of the womb. I don't think a lot of neuroscientists see it that way anymore. But basically that birth through 5 months is a period of symbiosis, and that's legitimate symbiosis because the child cannot take care of themselves, first of all, and the parents need to learn how to tune in to the communication of the child. So, you know, when are they hungry? When do they want to sleep? When do they need to be changed? All of those pieces. When do they want more stimulation? So there's a real cueing process that goes on back and forth as the connection and as the attachment are being solidified in those first few months of life. But Mahler said, starting really about 6 months, you see the beginning of the separation individuation process. And she described it as going on from about 6 months to about 36 months. And again, this is the rudimentary beginnings of separation individuation, because I think it goes on throughout our whole lives. But she described differentiation as that period, the beginning period, where the child starts to realize there's me and there's you. And you can see things like kids taking their parents' hand and putting their fingers in their mouths, or they'll start pulling the parents' hair and they'll get a reaction out of the parent. And so they begin to you know, the beginning sense of, okay, there's somebody else out in the world who's not me. Then by the time the child can crawl, and definitely by the time a child is walking, you had what she termed the practicing stage, which is a stage of exhilaration about some independence. There's exhilaration around running away from mom or dad. You'll also, I mean, if you watch young kids in a, like in an airport or a train station or somewhere where they, you can just see that glee on their face when they're able to run away from the parent. One sec. Then by about 18 months, she described, she used a French word, rapprochement, which means coming and going or back and forth. And that's the period in which the child both is demanding more independence than they've had in those first 18 months, but they also very much need to be cuddled and held and regress. And they move pretty quickly between those two. And, you know, the healthier parents are able to respond the majority of time to both sides of that continuum. And the ones who are not will either be very clinging or very rejecting of their child's independence, for example, or they'll leave their kid completely on their own. And the child then begins to be able to have to figure out a lot of self-soothing mechanisms because they're not getting it from the primary caretakers. And so by about 36 months, she called it the basically the beginning of libidinal object constancy. And libidinal object constancy is more than what Piaget meant. It's that emotional capacity to realize that mom or dad will come back. They do exist even when they're not in my presence. And they're able to take internal soothing, internal soothing from that person. And so the child who has a fairly good base of libidinal object constancy is not going to have the same kind of trouble with separation anxiety as the child who doesn't. And I mean, there is some separation anxiety that's probably genetic, and some people are probably more when they're born. But that development of the object constancy helps a person be able to start soothing themselves when the other person is not doing everything that they want them to do. So if you think about couples as going through a similar process, you can think about it like this, that, you know, two people get together. Before they meet, they're separate selves, they're separate people. They're going about their own lives in their own way, and then they meet each other. And when they meet each other, there is a merging of boundaries that takes place. There is a sense of bonding and attachment. And that initial symbiosis, which I sometimes call a period of temporary psychosis, because in that wonderful falling in love, you don't see the other person. You don't see things you don't want to see. You see the exciting things. You see the things that make it fun. And there, that serves a purpose. I think it serves a really important purpose. The couples who can remember what it was like when they fell in love have a base to fall back on when things get tough. And so you want to see that initial symbiosis. But sooner or later, you know, people begin to take their partners off that pedestal. And when they take their partners off that pedestal, they start to see the ways that they're different. And that process of beginning differentiation often starts with the first disillusionment. It often starts when you go, ooh, you know, something happened that was really unexpected. And you say, well, wait a minute, maybe this person is not who I thought they were. It also starts when people want to reclaim some of their own lives. You know, that when in that falling in love where they spend all their time together, they sacrifice time with friends, with family. And then after they've been together for a while, they want to, you know, reclaim those other relationships. And so they start to have individual desires that surface. And all of that is normal and natural. Now, if a differentiation process goes on well, if it goes on successfully, then you'll even have people moving more into their own individual development. And they'll start to do things that strengthen their self-esteem apart from the relationship. So that could be things they do with their career. It could be things they do with hobbies. It could be things they do with volunteer work. I mean, there's all kinds of ways, but the primary focus during what I call when I'm talking to couples, I'll call it the exploration or independence stage. What's going on is, you know, I'm okay even if I'm not with my partner. And I don't need my partner to make me whole. Now, we'll get into this later a lot more, but some couples individuating, practicing stage without a base of differentiation underneath it. And when they don't have that base of differentiation, they usually do not treat their partners well. Now, if a couple is moving through the healthy, normal stages of couples development, after they've done a lot of that individuating, they begin to reconnect. They begin to come back together, and they actually start creating more of a we again. They start not being afraid of the intimacy, long-term relationship. They start to take more risks. It is still a back and forth for a while of testing. Can I be independent and can I be close? And are both of those available to me? And the final stage is the stage of synergy. It's a stage of mutual interdependence. It's a stage where 1+1 is greater than 2. Unfortunately, we don't see too many of these couples in our practice because they don't need us. But a long time ago, I interviewed a bunch of couples like this. Recently, I've also been interviewing some other similar kinds of couples. And, you know, when you're around couples who are like this, it's energizing to be around them. And most of us were not fortunate enough to have that in our parents, you know, to see that role model. So we're creating it as we go. So this slide is just a summary of what I've been saying about the stages in the couple and some of the things that are going on. But when you're assessing the couple in front of you, what you're looking at is what's the primary developmental stage of each partner? And then the assessment of the couple is based on, you know, two different people potentially being at two different places. So for example, there are a lot of couples, clinical case couples, ones who come to see us, who never got beyond the first stage. And so those are the symbiotic couples. They're the ones that are angry, fighting, aggressive, or highly conflict avoidant. Now, another common time for people to come to therapy is the symbiotic differentiating couple. This is the couple where one partner is still trying to hold on to the symbiosis, and the other partner is starting to express their own desires, their own wishes, and the relationship is unbalanced for the first time. And that unbalance is even more extreme when you hit the symbiotic, if you hit a couple where one person is practicing and the other person is symbiotic. And these couples, you probably, most of you have seen a couple like this, because they'll come in and one partner is talking about feeling smothered and completely smothered by the other, and the other partner's feeling abandoned. And they're feeling like they don't matter anymore, and the person's always gone and not treating them well. And we'll, you know, you'll have a whole lesson on understanding how they come to be that way and what happens in that kind of couple. The couples that are the most fun to work with in some ways are the couples where both people are differentiating. And if they're a new couple or relatively young couple, they can have a lot of work to do as each of them are differentiating, but they're putting energy in to the work, and they're starting to each show up as, this is who I am, this is what's important to me, this is what matters, and these are things we're going to have to work out because we're not mirror images of each other. So if you have a couple where both are symbiotic and they've been together more than 2 years, then you're going to have, and that's what I call an arrested developmental stage, and it results from chronic failed differentiation. And without the, you know, and this is what Tammy was talking about a little bit about the focus on the process. Without changing the process and strengthening the differentiation of each partner, they're going to keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. So, you know, we'll be looking throughout the year in where are your couples stuck? Where's the development arrested? What are the main sources of their pain, their disappointment, their frustrations? How have they hurt each other? And what is it going to take to repair some of the ways that they have hurt each other? And a really important piece to look at is how far off course are they from what you would expect in a normal developmental process of two people? Like if they're very young and they've been together 2 or 3 years, you would just barely beginning to expect that they would get into early differentiation. So if they come in and they're having struggles that are differentiation struggles, first thing you can say to them is, wow, you are doing exactly what you need to be doing. I mean, this is exactly what happens and you're right on track. You know, that's very different than a couple who've been together 30 years and have not done any development and they're starting now. So let me pause. I'm going to stop the screen share and see if there are questions that you guys have just with this overview, and then I'll shift gears and stay to answer things that people have about the program itself. But questions, comments, and you can unmute yourselves. Were you going to ask something? Was that Holly?
Oh, hi. I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Yes, actually, I had two questions. I can start with one. One is just what you were describing when you were describing in your words, the developmental stage is not what you just put up for us to look at. You know, you talked about, just because I was really liking the way you were wording it, if you can just give me a rough idea, you said separate selves before we meet, then meet each other and boundaries merge, bonding and attachment, symbiosis, and then beginning differentiation, take partner off the pedestal. People want to reclaim their lives, da, da, da. And then exploration and independence, strength and self-esteem apart from the relationship. I'm okay without my partner. And you explained that if you don't have a base of differentiation before exploration, there's some problems. There were two more, and you're wording it. Would you just say it again? Because it was really helping. Because this is so important, and I just want to get it. What were the other two?
So one is, the next one is rapprochement.
Yeah.
Which means coming and going.
Yeah.
And so that's a stage where people demand more independence and also really want to connect more.
Okay, that's the difference, right? Demanding the independence and wanting to connect.
And in fact, you'll sometimes have couples come in where they want to deepen their sexual connection at this point.
Okay.
That's a pretty common thing for couples in the rapprochement stage.
Indicator, okay. Okay. And then the final one?
The final one is synergy, or which I call, you know, 1 + 1 is way bigger than 2.
Right.
I mean, it's where the couple together really wants to create something in the world together. They have that kind of energy to give.
The whole is better than the parts kind of thing.
Yeah, because you've got two whole people and they've created some stuff together that makes them together like another entity almost.
Like you and your husband.
On our good days.
On your good days.
Yeah.
And I don't know, so may I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Thank you. The other question is, which you don't have to get into now, as I'm thinking about, you know, in a couple, let's just say if it's one partner that appears to be still in the symbiosis, the symbiotic stage, and I don't even know if you think of things this way, does that kind of equate, do you talk about, you know, I think about, you know, a partner that has the, you know, anxious attachment style, the pursuer, you know, do you want to say anything about that? Do you put those together? That's, don't even go there, just stay here with this.
Well, I mean, you'll hear a couple of lessons on attachment styles, and the attachment styles, like somebody who really does have an anxious anxious clinging type of attachment,
yeah,
is going to have a lot harder time with differentiation. They're going to cling to their partner.
Both is right. So you'll see, I see what you're saying. This is describing the stage and that, right. So you oftentimes someone who's getting real stuck with that, it's stemming from that, the attachment stuff.
It's stemming from the attachment and probably undeveloped capacities in their early development and all of that.
Right. But with this model, it sounds like, yeah, obviously that plays into it. We want to know about that, but maybe just in really understanding this model and how it's laid out, we can use this language without even having to get into that. Is that correct?
Nice. Yes, yes, yes. And in fact, on the website, for anybody who wants to get them, we have these little pamphlets that are called Stepping Stones to Intimacy.
Oh, okay.
Let me see if I have, one right here. I usually have them.
Okay. Oh yeah, we can order those. Yeah.
Yeah, you can order them, and they're written in lay language.
Perfect.
They're not written so that the, because I will sometimes give those to couples and ask them to take it home and talk to each other, read it, and see where they see themselves.
Yeah, great. Just because so many of the other ways of work with couples, it's all about, you know, the attachment styles. So this is perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Thank you. Anybody else?
Hi.
Hi.
Julie.
Hi.
Hi. I just have a question. Is it always really clear? Is it always really distinct and discreet, the phases, or do people have different, are they in different stages on different themes, or how does that work?
The way I think about it is that the primary stuckness that a couple has is a reflection of those stages. I mean, it is a reflection of what they have not been able to develop. Now, there are times that you get regression that even is to be expected, like after the birth of a baby, things are going to, you do want the primary caretaker to be able to get, you know, more connection, more help, more support, partner. So you'll see regression at times that makes sense. But if you know, what you'll learn as you go through the program, I think, is how to spot where people are stuck and what they do repetitively so that they can't promote the development of the relationship. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Could I ask a question, please, Ellen?
Yeah, sure.
Hi. This is Louise. I just wondered if you could give an indication as to what a practicing symbiotic couple might look like. What sort of things would be happening in their dynamic?
Absolutely. I mean, the most common thing that's happening is one partner is saying to you things like he or she are never home. They're always out with friends. I have a couple right now where he's a musician and he's gone with doing his music all the time. And the symbiotic partner is usually feeling very abandoned.
Okay. Because I've got a couple at the moment, and the wife is doing training. She's always doing her work. And the child is taking priority. And I think he's feeling, as you're describing, and I'd thought they were symbiotic, but obviously not then. It sounds more like she'll be a practicing.
Well, the way I determine it, like practicing has to do with individuation. It is that person genuinely developing a sense of self-esteem and a sense of who they are in the world, and they're getting real satisfaction out of what they're doing. So it's not avoidance. There are times that people will avoid their partners, but they're not, what they're doing isn't doing anything for them.
Right. Okay.
So
there'll be a fulfillment in what they're doing.
Yeah.
And perhaps with their friendships, with the relationship.
Yes. And like there are some people, I've seen this actually quite a bit in sexual abuse survivors, where they, when they start to individuate, that strengthening that they experience from really having mastery in the world helps them then have the strength to go back and do the differentiation work with their partners. And so there are, you know, it's a bad thing always to go into individuation before differentiation. I'm just saying right. that it's easier to support individuation in a couple when the partners are not afraid of the differentiation process.
Okay. Right. Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question, Ellen.
Sure.
I worked with couples who are very religion-based, and I'm wondering if you would comment on the male usually is the practicing one and wants and does all the stuff but wants to keep the spouse under control and at home in more of a symbiotic relationship. Would the male also be in a symbiotic relationship, or are they really practicing?
I've seen it both ways, so I don't know without looking at it in a little more detail if I could answer that. But one of the ways you can start to tell more is if that spouse who's at home is saying, wait a minute, I have some things that I want to do, or I, you know, they're starting to express their own feelings more, and you see how the partner responds to it. like if he really is responding in a way that says, I'm not going to tolerate this, you're talking about somebody who's probably mainly symbiotic.
And that's what I get is that the usually the spouse that's at home wants to begin to differentiate, and that's why I come in, because the male spouse is saying no,
yeah,
and trying to keep that symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, then you're probably dealing with one that's stuck at the first stage still.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate
you're
that.
You're welcome. So I want to say, I'm going to shift for a minute, and then anybody who doesn't need to hear me say a little bit more about the program, you're welcome to go, and I'll say this, and then I'll just stay for any last questions that anybody has about either. But for a lot of therapists, when they start this program, it feels a bit overwhelming and normal. That's natural. And what I really want you guys to think about is there's so much help here for you, whether it's from me, whether it's from Ruth, if it's something logistical, but also from the supporting people who will write in and answer your questions. So that you can write on the website whenever you have a question. In a couple weeks, we'll set up peer groups, so those of you who want to can be in a peer group. And what I like to say is, you know, if you learn, like, think about how you learn best. And if you learn best by reading, then just be sure you read the lessons that are going to come to you every 2 weeks. There's a lot of learning in those lessons. And so that's one chunk that I really say, put your time into reading those, mark a time on your calendars. You can read a lesson in about 45 minutes. And it's only every 2 weeks that you're gonna get those lessons. So be sure you read them. The section on the website that's called Special Training Calls, if you start at the bottom of that list, they are all the different theoretical pieces of this model being taught very specifically about the theory, the interventions. And so that's a deep dive into what is there. And you can use them in support of reading. The calls, like the clinical calls, are to apply the model. So we do a lot with cases, and we'll have a case in February. And those are designed to really look at how do you apply the theory in the real clinical situation. And those are great learning. And you're going to have people come to those calls that are at all levels of learning the developmental model. And that's fine. So you will have people, sometimes the level two people come to these calls, sometimes it's all level one people, but it's basically designed to immerse you into the clinical application. You'll also see some emails about bonus calls. And when you're getting started, I would say those are the least, I bring other presenters in to teach things that are relevant, that are support around the model. But if you have a limited amount of time, I would say sacrifice those at the beginning and put your time into the special training calls and into the clinical calls and into the lessons. But by all means, reach out, let yourself get help. You know, if you get behind, don't worry about it. There's just a lot of help and support here for you. So are there questions that anybody has or comments or just...
Ellen, can I add one thing to that?
Sure. This is Lauren.
A lot of people will post that, you know, I don't have any couples right now. That's fine. you'll actually find that you can apply a lot of the developmental model to individual clients because they're all in relationships. So it applies to lots of different clients, not just couples.
Thank you. And this, let me introduce Lauren. This is Lauren, and she is one of my helpers, and you will see her writing on the site a lot. Lauren is fabulous with helping and giving you ideas, and some of you, I think, have already run into some help from her.
Thank you. I love to be here.
Yeah, you're a gem.
Thank you. So are you. And so is everyone else here. It's a wonderful community and very supportive at that as well. Nice to see you, Tammy. I see you up there.
Anybody else have questions, comments? Well, let me ask you this as we get ready to say goodbye, just if you have the time to put anything in the chat as you leave, just share a word or two about how you're feeling, what you're experiencing as you leave and say goodbye this morning, today. And I will see you soon too, because the next call, well, Catherine's special training call would be a great one to come to. And that's the one on February 10th. February 3rd will be a bonus call about premarital work. Thank you, Holly.
Ellen?
Yes.
This is the other Holly.
Hi, Holly.
You've got two Hollies, or at least two Hollies. As a second year student of yours, I want to say that, you know, what I have found has worked for me, and I want to give encouragement to those who work this way, who learn this way, is that I've taken things that I've learned and then tried to find moments to begin to apply it with my couples. And so it's been in some ways like jumping off the high dive, but the more that I jump into the water, the more I realize I can swim. And it doesn't always, you know, it and I learn by what goes well and what doesn't go so well.
I like how you put that, jumping into the water, taking that risk and just letting yourself see what you learn. Anybody else? Anything? Okie doke. Well, I will see you soon. And keep us posted. If you haven't introduced yourself in the Getting Acquainted, please do. And I will see you soon.